Hey, it's the PC Gamer Show. I'm James Davenport, editor, and today we're talking about the sad, slow death of Anthem. It's canceled. Big bummer. Then Wes is taken over to chat with John Henry Thompson, a postdoc fellow at NYU, who was a key figure in the design of Macromedia Director, the predecessor to Adobe Flash. For Black History Month, we talked to Thompson about his career and how Director enabled artists to develop games and animation without knowing how to code. We're joined by none other than Larry Cooperman of Night Dive Studios, which specializes in restoring classic games. It's a great episode. Stick around.
Steven, how you doing?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm not good because...
Why?
Anthem's canceled. It's officially canceled.
Wait, what?
Yeah, man. It's no good.
Just kidding. I knew that, James.
We all knew. We all secretly knew.
Right. We've known for years at this point.
So long. But let's talk about how we got. Let's revisit. Let's do the timeline. How did we get here?
Yes.
Well, Anthem releases February 22nd, 2019, and it's not good. Steven, you reviewed it and not favorably. You know, what was the deal there?
Yeah, I mean, you know, Anthem, I think, was like a very anticipated game. People were very excited for it. I mean, it's BioWare, right? Anything that BioWare makes, people are going to be really excited for. And, you know, we started sort of getting, I remember being sort of confused, right? Like we played the beta, they had sort of open betas and you're kind of playing it and being like, okay, like maybe it'll get better a little bit longer. Or like there's some stuff here that seems kind of, but I don't know, it's not the full game. But it came out, I finally, you know, got to play through it from start to finish. And it was, I think, underbaked. It is like the easiest way of putting it. Like there was just, it was a mess of half realized ideas. There was, you know, systems that just didn't make sense. There was this weird single player story that was bolted on to the multiplayer component, but in like the most infuriating way, where every time you finished a mission, you had to walk like this 45 second, 1 minute walk from where you spawned in the single player area back to the mission table. So like it was just, the world felt very static. It had none of the BioWare magic that you've sort of come to love and expect from games like Mass Effect. And so it was just, it was massively disappointing. And then after I reviewed it, as time went on, I think the more and more flaws were revealed. The combat didn't work properly. The math behind the RPG systems didn't work properly. There was bugs and glitches, and it was just a mess from top to bottom, sad to say.
Gotcha. Well, shit.
Yeah.
What happened next?
And like that happened, and you know, there was sort of this initial backlash, and finally in June of 2019, which, like, keep in mind, it came out in February, so it took about five months is my math. Yeah. EA CEO Andrew Wilson to like finally acknowledge that Anthem had a rough launch. Of course, they, you know, they want to sort of couch the blows and pull punches there and say, oh, we understand that you're not happy. But, you know, even then, when they were talking about it, they said they're going to stick with it. They were committed to this, you know, 7 to 10 year cycle. We have this quote here where he's like, so if I think about Anthem on a 7 to 10 year cycle, it may not have had the start that many of us wanted, including our players, but I feel like the team is really going to get there with something special and something great because they've demonstrated that they can. So, you know, right away they really came out and were like, well, not right away, but 5 months later, after players were languishing in this buggy game, EA came forward and said, you know, we're here for the long run.
Yeah. And knowing what we know today, this reads a little, it stings a bit. It stings a bit to read this quote.
Hindsight is terrible.
Yeah. Shortly after August 6th in 2019. Wow. That's so long ago. Anthem's big cataclysm event. This is sort of like, it's meant to sort of cap off the first push of the live game, sort of design they planned out. And this finally arrives after a month of delays, and it also kind of sucks. Can you give me like a short understanding of what we got and why it was bad?
Yeah, this was the moment where I really realized that I felt like Anthem was hopeless, because Cataclysm was the thing that they'd been teasing since before its launch, is the big end game, you know, edition. They were going to, it was going to come out afterwards and it was going to be this amazing thing. And it was going to be like the capstone that put Anthem together. And so naturally it became the thing that everyone was holding out hope for would redeem this game. Cataclysm was like this weird ass game mode where you went into a storm and you had to like explore this map, and there was objectives and a timer that you had to complete them within, and completing the objectives, I think, would like add to your timer. And so it was sort of like a score attack mode. Like you were going in and you sort of had to find the right way to explore this zone to sort of maximize your points, which is like not a bad idea, but like that is like the most antithetical thing I can think of to sort of the immersion that you want from, you know, live service games where you get the RPG growth. Like where is that? How does that like plug into your character's growth and journey that you're going through? It felt like an arcade game bolted on top of, you know, what was otherwise like a very pretty and very cool game. But it was also just not what they promised that Cataclysm was going to be. Cataclysm was supposed to be like this very, you know, you were supposed to be going into this storm and it was scary and constantly changing and it was supposed to be very dangerous. And then you're playing this thing and the storm is basically just, if you are outside of these bubbles, your health slowly ticks away and everything was blue and the wind and the trees were bent over in the wind. Like that was the extent of it. So it was just like everything else in Anthem. It just felt like they were trying their best and not even getting close to a finish line.
Bummer.
And so, you know, things continued to kind of get more dire because on August 15th, Ben Irving, who is the lead producer and in many ways the face of Anthem, announced that he would be leaving BioWare. So that's not a good sign.
Not a great thing to follow up, you know, a very disappointing climactic event in your live game with when your lead producer dips out, like,
yeah,
a week later.
See ya.
But of course,
you know, they're like, oh, we promise that like it's in capable hands, everything's gonna be fine. Again, hindsight puts a lot of these events in a different light.
I still had some faith at this point, but it started changing pretty quickly because this shortly after BioWare announced a shift from the live game format of acts, which are these kind of big chunky updates featuring new locations and story, to something simpler in the form of seasonal updates, while they decided to give Anthem a more thorough review and reworking. And these seasonal updates, you know, they were sort of lacking that narrative and the stuff you were seeing in place and continue to see in places like Destiny and Warframe. These were just sort of like tweaks on what was already there, and didn't really change much. Pretty disappointing in that regard. But
it really quickly became clear that like there was no plan for Anthem, which was another thing that they had promised, right? Like you know, Andrew Wilson saying like they before launched it was this 10-year plan. They had this thing, and then they start sort of executing on this plan, and you're right, like it was just like, all right, this month the monsters have more HP. That's our live event. And it was like, oh boy, this like this horse doesn't even have legs in this race.
Rough stuff.
And so more people started leaving the project because in November 2019 the head of live service Chad Robertson also left BioWare. This was after 14 years at the company. And you know, we don't know for sure. Of course, like there's always sort of the formal reason that they give, and you know, there's no necessarily a reason to distrust that. But it just does not look good when the people involved in a project are jumping ship. As it's, you know, at this point, like you have to remember, like the community was pissed. Like the backlash to it was severe. People were upset. They had spent, you know, $60 on this game, and so people started vacating the project, sort of at a very interesting time.
Definitely. And then later in also in November, a Kotaku report followed up sort of our mounting fears with a report that said BioWare is completely rehauling Anthem. And they were internally referring to this as Anthem 2.0. So, you know, kind of confirming our fears while also maybe stoking the fires of hope in some regard.
Yeah. And like in May 2020, they came out with it. Wow. I can't believe that was in May of last year, but
that gap.
What is time? So you know, another long amount of months went by before BioWare like actually acknowledged what was said in that report on Kotaku and said, yeah, Anthem's getting a major makeover. In July, they released some concept art of a new pirate faction, and they began this trend of showing off or making these blog posts. So I think it was their attempt to sort of take people on their journey and sort of win back goodwill to show them like the work that they were planning on doing. And so they, you know, they showed off a new pirate faction. They released a blog post where they acknowledged some of the bigger complaints with the games and promised more loot.
Better loot. Yeah. Later. And then this continued for a while. In October, we saw like the next big sort of evidence of this next version of Anthem in the work they'd done on a redesign of Javelin progression systems, which looked pretty neat, way more in terms of variability and choice, way more in depth. It was hinting at something that looked closer to, you know, an RPG where builds were very distinct and mattered a lot more compared to what was there when it launched.
Yeah. And then things just kind of kept going. I think there were a few more blog posts that were just sort of like, hey, stuff's happening, guys, behind the scenes, the gears are turning. but then in February 2021, so wow, this month, geez, what is time again? we got some more inside scoops, and really it was these inside scoops that have helped us have the best sort of insight into what's going on with Anthem. But a Bloomberg report said that executives were reviewing the status of Anthem very soon and would decide whether or not to continue with its development.
Yeah.
So that was like, it put this guillotine blade over Anthem's head and nobody really knew what the outcome was going to be for a while until obviously now. Then the next step happened.
Apparently it wasn't enough because just yesterday, February 24th, I think Bloomberg also came out beforehand, like an hour beforehand. I don't know if this prompted BioWare to just push out a blog post immediately or not. But Bloomberg report announced that Anthem was reportedly canceled. Development was canceled, that the presentation did not go over well, whatever that was. I would love to be a fly on the wall in that room. And then BioWare, shortly after via a blog post announced that Anthem development was officially done for.
You have to imagine at that point, BioWare was like, we got a mole. And if we don't announce it, Bloomberg is going to. I mean, it's worth clarifying, like the Kotaku report, the Bloomberg report, this was all the same person. This was Jason Schreier, who obviously is a very reputable investigative journalist and is great at these kinds of things. And so he was the one spilling all the beans on Anthem over the past couple of years. And now it's dead.
It's time of death. Yeah.
February 24th.
Flatlined. It's a bummer, but I don't know, like let's kind of like look at this in a greater context. What do you think? You mentioned earlier in when we talked about your review what you thought about Anthem at the time, but what do you think, let's like really boil it down, what do you think was fundamentally wrong with Anthem to begin with? How did we get here to begin with?
So, you know, some of this is based off of assumptions that were put forth in like the original Kotaku report about its development hell and the issues that were going there. But I think like really Anthem just didn't have a vision, and it really came through. That was sort of one of the points in the Kotaku report. And I think, you know, seeing that was like, or reading that the first time was like a puzzle piece falling into place where I suddenly understood why I didn't like this game. I mean, I understood why I didn't like it, but that was sort of, it was a moment where I got to say, oh, I understand what's going on behind the scenes. Because I think the game just lacked vision. And, you know, the report allegedly like BioWare didn't let people at the studio, it didn't want people at the studio looking at games like Destiny. You didn't want it looking at the competition because they didn't want to be derivative of it. But it's like, you got to be familiar with what other games in the space are doing, because how else are you going to iterate and be better than they are, right?
Yeah.
So I think those were the problems to begin with. I think that there was a horrific, whoever made the decision of trying to do like the live service thing, but also wedge in BioWare's like traditional storytelling and single player experience. I think that what you ended up just doing was dividing the game in half. And the single player stuff sucked. Like the story was not good. The acting was like some of the worst. Like it, and you know, there was apparently big rewrites and revisions made, which has obviously been a theme with BioWare. I mean, the Mass Effect trilogy ending was obviously a huge controversial thing that was rewritten in the late game as well. But like, so yeah, I think like Anthem just had so many flaws, even though it had some really cool ideas. Like the exosuit flying was really, really fun. But it just didn't know how to take any of that and build an actual game out of it. It was all these disparate parts, these different, you know, competing aspects that just never gelled.
Yeah. And why do you think, like, again, this is all speculation, but as I said, like, so it looked like good progress was being made. There was something, there was a better, more ideal version of Anthem potentially on the way. Why do you think EA figured in that room? Why do you think they figured those executives decided that it wasn't worth salvaging even after a year plus of tinkering?
Well, and you make a good point. Like live service games, it's not, I mean, there's an art to them, but there's also a science, like very much a science to making these types of games that
Destiny
people want to play.
It's an ongoing science. It is an ongoing
science. It's a new frontier, but it is like a science in a sense. And so like there's a blueprint there that you can follow. I think a couple of things factored into this decision. BioWare in its statement talked about the coronavirus pandemic. And, you know, I've seen people online or whatever sort of raising their eyebrows and wondering if that's just a convenient excuse. I absolutely think that is true and that they're being honest about that. Coronavirus has like devastated the games industry in a lot of ways. And it's forcing, I think, everybody to tighten their belts. And I think that, you know, maybe there's an alternate universe where coronavirus didn't exist and Anthem might have been allowed to continue surviving. Yeah. But I think in this day and age, you know, companies really got to be shoring up leaks in their ship. And I think Anthem just represented a really big leak. I think the other thing, and I've been thinking about this a lot, right? Because there's been some really great underdog comeback stories with video games over the years. You know, Final Fantasy 14 is obviously the big one of a game that released in a probably worse state than Anthem. I mean, we reviewed it lower than we reviewed Anthem. And so like just a dire state. And it is now like you and I are just huge fans of that game. Like I love that game. Yeah. So, you know, there's a blueprint there as well. But I think the difference with that is that like, you know, Anthem was not this cherished, you know, I hate this word, but like intellectual property. It wasn't this cherished series. You know, people didn't have this emotional connection to Anthem that they might have had with Mass Effect or Dragon Age. And so I just don't think that there was the right ingredients in for that kind of comeback story, right? Final Fantasy, people love Final Fantasy. It's been around forever. Yeah. People are invested in that series. People don't care about Anthem. I mean, people like the game. It still has its diehard fans or whatever, but like by and large, most people don't care about the future of Anthem's world or its world building or its characters. And so I think without those hooks, like there's just not a lot there. I think the other thing too, you know, this is me playing armchair developer and I totally recognize that. But I think the way that BioWare went around it was all wrong. I think they were too slow to acknowledge the backlash. And I think they were too slow to act on it too. I think doing like a big rework maybe could have worked, who knows. But I think the fact that, you know, it wasn't until, May 2020 that BioWare finally acknowledged that it was doing a rework on the game, like, that's crazy. They needed to move way quicker. I think they needed to make more strides quicker. Like, you know, Square Enix with Final Fantasy 14, not to keep drawing this comparison, but like, if you pay attention to that story, Square Enix sunk an incredible amount of money and resources into rebuilding Final Fantasy 14. I don't think BioWare's heart was in it. I think that they were working on Dragon Age, that they were obviously working on a new Mass Effect. And then Anthem was sort of like, my sense of it was that maybe they had a skeleton crew working on it. And if they came up with something magical, they would, you know, consider investing more fully in a rework, the Anthem 2.0, but I don't think that ever would have yielded the results that they were hoping for. So I think the project was doomed from the start based on the execution of how they wanted to do the rework. And so I think, EA sat in that room and they probably were just like, it was probably a lot of what we saw in the blog posts where it was, oh, we're going to make the loot better and the suits are going to be, you know, it's going to have builds. It's going to be focused on builds, like these sort of archetypal roles that they'll fill in a party. And I just don't think any of that stuff's inspiring. None of that stuff's going to inspire people to suddenly care about Anthem again. So
well put, well put. So do you think BioWare is just Dragon Age, Mass Effect from here on, playing it safe for the next decade minimum?
Like, yeah, I mean, because you know, they are working on a new Mass Effect, they're working on a new Dragon Age. I think Dragon Age, I think, is closer to a release than Mass Effect is. Mass Effect feels very sort of early, but I think by the time Mass Effect comes out, easily a decade will have passed. Or, you know, by the time both of them, closer to a decade, right? And so I think, yeah, BioWare, just stick to your strengths. At the end of the day, it never made sense for BioWare to chase the live service trend, you know, and we just see this time and time again when you've been in the industry long enough. Like, you know, I remember when I first got into the industry, MOBAs were the big thing. Everybody was making a MOBA and now it's live service games. And it's just like, God, you know, by the time you, as a studio, by the time you decide that you should make one of these trendy game genres, it's already too late. Unless you have serious magic. I think it's just 90% of the time you're going to flop and you're going to fail. And so it's like, they should,
Fucking Avengers couldn't do it. It's one of the biggest properties in the world. And, you know, I'm sure there's other reasons for that, but you got to be early. You got to be there during like the creation moment almost to really get in.
We've seen it with battle royales too. Like what was I'm trying to think, Cliff Bleszinski's battle royale pivot that he made after Lawbreakers. The one where it was all about money or whatever. It was weird. You know, you just see it time and time again. The other thing is, like, I don't think BioWare needs to be ashamed of being just the Dragon Age Mass Effect studio. People fucking love Dragon Age and Mass Effect. Like, lean into your strengths, goddammit. Why did you try and make Anthem in the first place when you have these two properties that people just want more of? So, you know, it's good that BioWare, I think, is just going back to its roots here.
You know, I asked that question and I was kind of like, I asked it as sort of my emotion asking it was like, oh, this is kind of disappointing. But now that I think about it, no, this is probably for the best. Definitely for the best. Not necessarily for the best, but Dragon Age, Mass Effect, I'll take more of that. I don't know. Looking back at this, wow, time. But what do you think we can all, as players, people in the industry, what do you think we sort of take away from this bummer?
I think everyone can take away different things. I think players, I think one thing that really stood out to me with this was an understanding that like a game's failures often are not the results of the developers, like the on the line, frontline developers working on a game. And I think with the, you know, based on the Kotaku report and stuff like that, it made a very strong case that Anthem's problems were at the top. And I think that is something that people need to keep in mind when they're talking about games, when they're interacting with the discourse on social media and stuff like that. You know, God forbid you ever like come face to face with like a BioWare developer to their face. Like, remember that these are people who sunk years of their lives into this thing. And almost all of its issues, I think, were caused by corporate you know, stuff that was beyond their control. So I think, you know, that's one thing to always take away. I think the other thing, like I said, you know, don't chase trends, please God, studios. Like, you know, I think it doesn't work out more times than it does work out. And the times where it does work out, it's because those studios actually genuinely had some good lightning in a bottle. And even then, you know, we never know about the games that don't exist. So the games that get cut, you know, 2 years of silent development and then they get canceled. So I think that, and I think the other thing is like the other thing with Anthem was just, God, people bought into the hype on that game real hard. And it's just, you know, it's a cliche at this point, but like, don't pre-order. Stop. don't do that. Don't buy into a game. You know, as good as a game might look before release, it's not, you should never like become emotionally invested in it before you've had a chance to play it for yourself. And, you know, part of this is a selfish thing. I caught a lot of flack for that negative Anthem review and I'm not complaining. I'm by no means am I a victim, or anything, but you know, people were really mad that we reviewed it negatively, before it was, you know, really out there and people had a chance to play it from end to end. And yeah, I think it's just, it's important to take a step back and remember that, these are just games and, you know, people pour their life and their soul soul into it, and then it blows up in their face for reasons out of their control. And the only one you should be mad at are executives, because rich people are evil.
Just look to cyberpunk.
I'm just kidding. That took like a weird
rich people like, are comrade. Evil.
Yeah, yeah. Down with the bourgeoisie.
it was mostly a joke.
But I think
we get where you're coming from. We as critical thinkers, I'm speaking for the viewer right now, but we as critical thinkers understand what you're saying, Stephen. And I think we can all agree, and even though as a player myself, I do get sucked up into the cycle and understand
where these
people are coming from. So
we all buy into the hype.
Definitely. Well, Stephen, appreciate your time. I'm very happy for you that I know anytime in the Slack, anytime Anthem comes up, it feels like, and I'm right there alongside you, it feels like we just have all these emotions that come pouring out, and we can finally let go. It's disappointing overall.
We're free.
I'm, you know, and I'm sure it's painful for BioWare and the people there as well. And, but it's, we can all move on. We can all like let this thing go and hopefully,
it feels like a scene in a movie where like the main character's asshole dad dies, and it's like that bittersweet. They like go to the bar to like have a drink over it and like commiserate together. That's how I feel today. I am sad, but you're right. Like I'm also just a little bit relieved that now it's just done. Like, thank God we don't have to keep hearing Anthem headlines pop up anymore.
I'm getting a,
What?
Okay. Stephen, I'm sorry, but the podcast is canceled. The show is canceled. The video is canceled. Yeah.
What?
Yeah. I know you invested a lot into this, but it sucks. So we got to go.
Are you kidding me?
It's done. It's canceled.
I've been working on this for years.
No. Pack your bags. Bye.
Hey everybody, this is Wes from PC Gamer, and I'm here on sort of a unusual format for us, a special interview. Joining me is John Henry Thompson and Larry Cooperman. You guys want to say hey real quick?
Hi.
Hello.
And we're here today to talk about John Henry's experience working in a field of software that I feel like probably a lot of PC gamers today maybe don't know a whole lot about, which is Macromedia Director and the technology behind a lot of 90s CD-ROM games and interactive software and stuff that kind of led into the Flash game era. So I don't know, let's get started. Can you each tell me a little bit about how you got into the PC world, starting with you, John Henry?
Well, my earliest PC wasn't a PC. I guess it was a S100 bus 8-bit CPM computer. I spent a good amount of money on.
What year was that?
Probably 1978.
And how did you go from being a young computer enthusiast to somebody who is actually writing computer software?
Well, I started early. I was fortunate to get into a computer lab at my high school, at Bronx High School of Science. They had a computer lab, probably one of the only computer lab in maybe the state, I don't know. But they had a computer lab that was open to 11th graders, but I was able to get in as a 10th grader. So computers was like the holy grail for me. So I wanted to figure out how they worked and understand how to control them, because I knew there was more than what the myth was that they're going to take over the world. I knew somebody had to build them and somebody had to control them. So I wanted to be in the driver's seat. So, so I learned to program on BASIC in my sophomore year in high school and kept at it ever since. I started off mainly interested in how computers worked and the technology behind it and languages, computer languages, and then migrated to creative expression, which I'm still very interested in. I'm kind of back in my my second home here at NYU ITP, Interactive Telecommunication Program in the Tisch School of the Arts, that looks at the creative uses of technology you know, beyond what's on the screen to creative expression. So, so does that answer you? I kind of jumped.
Yeah. I think that's a good segue for Larry, who also has some history with NYU, though not quite in the same way.
It's funny, Les. We John Henry, you and I have so many commonalities in background. Either Wes did a really deep dive into our backgrounds and knew more about us than we care to disclose, or this was just a fortuitous alignment. But we both went to Bronx Science, and we both went to NYU. I did start off as a computer science major at NYU. Back a million years ago, but I shifted. As I said, I did a pivot, and I ended up graduating with a degree in speech and theater education. So I was probably in the next building from you, or just across the street. My first personal computer was a Commodore 64. I could use my C64 with my Hess data modem. Which was a blazing fast 300 baud modem to go online so that I could actually do the coding and then print out the program that I had written and get it the next day. So it was the remote aspect of it that got me started with computers. Then I just celebrated my 20th year in the games area. I'm part of the team. I'm head of business development at Night Dive Studios, and our company is dedicated. I mean, all that we do is we bring back the classic games that would otherwise be lost. But I originally got into the business side of games by virtue of coming in from enterprise software sales. So again, we have a lot of commonality in that. And I remember some of the great games that were. That were made with Mac Meridia Director.
Which one was your favorite?
So I had some of my favorites, but under pain of death, my developers told me that at some point during this discussion, I had to talk to you about Total Distortion.
Oh yes, Mark Sparks. Yeah, Total Distortion. That was a gem. Yeah.
Why don't we set the stage a little by talking about, you know, for people who aren't familiar, what sure. Macromedia Director was, John Henry, your role, you know, in creating it, and then we can talk about some of the really cool games that resulted from it.
So Macromedia Director was a brainchild of Mark Canner, who came out of the Chicago game industry. You know, they built console games, and what he was frustrated with was that artists didn't have a tool that they could directly use to make games. You know, he came from he was working in the game industry mainly from the sound, but he came from opera and, you know, Oberlin and like multimedia installations, you know, wild and crazy stuff. So he brought that sensibility to the PC, and he was looking around for a computer that could, you know, can realize that kind of accessible tool, you know, visual, not based on numbers. And he fell in love with the Macintosh. And so he produced actually three groundbreaking softwares. VideoWorks, which later became Director, it started off as an animation program, cell animation. Mm-hmm. SoundWorks, which was a visual audio compositing application. And MusicWorks, which was note, you know, like you could see the actual clips and drag notes around. You know, it was a very popular and groundbreaking piece of software. It was used for the early Macintosh, for the guided tour of the Macintosh. That was the interactive version of Director. First it started on VideoWorks. VideoWorks Interactive added a very simple, basic interpreter to it. You know, but it had the classic timeline, and scripts could get attached to it. So I think till today, a very effective way of showing interactivity, because you could see it. You know, you didn't have to deal with code all the time. So Director grew out of that. Director grew out of VideoWorks Interactive in the 80s. This is probably around 85, 88. And I ran into Mark because he was looking for people to work on the product. It kind of rode the emergence of multimedia, where the computer became more than just, you know, a spreadsheet. It became a game, and, you know, built-in sound, built-in audio, built-in graphics, color graphics. My main role in Director was the scripting language, Lingo, which I brought in early on in first in Director Interactive, but it was brought in piece by piece. There was originally a very basic like interpreter written by Jay Fenton, who was the chief architect of the animation engine, and I replaced it with Lingo, which was inspired by at that time by a couple of things. One was Lisp, and the ease of use of BASIC, and the prominent language at that time was HyperTalk. The key point of those languages was, unlike most languages at that point, it was designed for non-engineers. It was designed for creative professionals. So in the case of HyperCard, it was English-like. You had, you know, put this in, put X into card 5. So it read like English, and even the coordinate system, rather than talking about X and Y, talk about horizontal and vertical. So the whole kind of tilt of the language was very inviting to creative people that weren't used to dealing with numbers. So it's kind of Lingo built on top of that. And then as the industry grew and other people came on and got the multimedia buzz, there was ScriptX, there was Mpropolis, but everybody was trying to crack this this nut of interactivity in an easy way. And but Macromedia was the first. We kept at it, and you know, with Director 4 we hit the PC, and then it was like an explosion, because the PC was a very affordable playback platform. So a lot of people in our developer community, which is the people that use Director, it turns out it was more you know, people that were bringing their other skills to the computer, like graphic artists, animators, you know, people like Joe Sparks, who first created Total Distortion. And before the Total Distortion, he made a game with, what's the name of that game? But anyway, he made an early game using Director. That's a quick summary of the history of Director and multimedia.
And John Henry, was the title you were looking for, Spaceship Warlock?
Right, exactly, Spaceship Warlock. Done with another, it was Joe Sparks and another, a comic book artist.
I think we should talk more about the game that you guys seemed excited to talk about earlier, before I asked for
Total
some background.
Distortion. Which is
Total Distortion. Yeah, tell us about this.
Well, go ahead.
No, go ahead, John Henry. You're the one that was a point on it, that I was just a player.
Okay. Well, that was at least a second game for the principal, Joe Sparks. He'd worked on Spaceship Warlock, and in Total Distortion, Joe Sparks followed his musical passion, and it was just chock full of original, you know, music. And the theme of the game was very interesting too. It was, you were somehow transported to this other universe where you had to, fueled your energy supply was by making music videos and sending them back to the subconscious of people in the, you know, that's how, but the main part of that was a big arc of the game, but there was all these, there was, I don't know, dozens of these little mini games. It was visual. It was a fun kind of buffet of games, and, you know, unusual games and good music. So, and I think Joe joined Macromedia and did some Shockwave stuff, some, you know, some web-based stuff.
The Total Distortion thing was, if you had somebody who was a non-gamer, who was coming from the music business, and you told them to make something that was a game, but about their music business, and that person was very creative, that's what you would get. The idea that somebody would think of that it was non-sequential. It wasn't that you do one thing and then that leads you to something else. Everything was kind of in its own standalone little environment, but it was really very, very creative.
One thing I'm really curious about is, to what degree, while you were working on Director and it started being picked up and used for lots of games and lots of software, you know, what kind of awareness did you have at the time that, like, oh, this is a pretty big deal, versus recognizing some of that in hindsight? You know, what did it feel like to be working on it in the 90s and seeing it pick up so much?
It didn't seem, it was an exciting time. It was an interesting time. I didn't feel like I was part of a, you know, we were always in a niche. You know, it seemed like we were, you know, the bigger people, the bigger guys were, you know, there was a PC world was bigger, you know, there was, you know, we were doing all the simple little, you know, game thing. And, you know, there were much bigger companies, Microsoft, Apple with ScriptX, you know, there was a lot of big players dealing with not just games, but interactivity in general. I think what we had was a close link to the creative community, because it was a community of developers. So, and, you know, we had a yearly developer conference that people could meet, and we were, we could transform with the technology. So, you know, we went from the PC, you know, desktop to the web, and brought in smart people to, at least in our area, to see what was the next thing for creative professionals with Dreamweaver. And it had a big plus in that, you, especially for people that were doing work on the Macintosh, which was the majority of people back then, in terms of desktop publishing and animation, and people that were not making PC games. You know, even PC games was a specialty. You know, you dealt with very low level code, and you had Doom, and you know, John, Carmack, you know, doing 3D stuff. You know, they were into pushing the hardware with code as far as they could push it. We were, you know, trying to just get people to do simple animations that could be used not only for games, but simulations, marketing, education. I mean, in retrospect now, is what I see is there was a big cultural expression that we're losing now, you know, that we don't have access to, unless, you know, folks work really hard, like Larry's working on, to resurrect it for the new hardware. There's no financial incentive or motivation by the company that owns this intellectual property to just make it easier, you know, just open source it, or open source a little bit of it enough. So it's a digital loss that I feel now. You know, we can talk about total distortion, but we can't play it anywhere. You know, it's just, and then, yeah, it's an interesting time to see the new forms of things without any barriers, you know, very minimal barriers. You know, if they had a time and they had a computer, yeah, they were good to go.
One could say that a lot of your early work was, I mean, it was really at an inflection point for the first time, you know, people who were from the, I'm tempted to say creative, but coders are creative also. But people that were coming from a non-computer background were now able to access the tools and see it as something as an open domain that they could, another place that they could do their creative work.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that was what was exciting for me about that time. And at the same time, I was teaching at NYU, the Tisch School of the Arts. So that was a program that exposed graduate students to this new media, you know, and it started off in HyperCard, and then it went evolved to Director, and now it's, you know, Arduinos and stuff on the web and VR. But that's the part of the industry that I like, is seeing how people can push this hardware into people's lives in new ways.
Going back to what you said, John Henry, about, you know, John Carmack was programming games like Doom, right, in the 90s, which was a very different thing from what Director was doing. But I feel like by the same token, both of them were, when people are making games, they tend to really push hardware to the extreme for that purpose, especially when the hardware isn't built for to make games. So I have to imagine there were people who started using Macromedia Director kind of in the same way to do things you hadn't really envisioned for the software, to kind of bend it to their will to be able to make games with it.
Yeah, it was games and just other, you know, other like marketing stuff, you know, like encyclopedias and people. Just the variety of stuff that people were experimenting with, you know. Shockwave was one of the big things when Director was able to deliver stuff on the web was Shockwave, which became a whole site in itself. You know, there was this technology to deliver the game, but it was so popular that they created a site to showcase all the games, and Macromedia spun off a company that didn't go very far, but it was a Shockwave company that was going to become a media company. And I think they hired those crazy cartoon guys, the Park,
The South Park?
South Park guys, yeah. And the story, I don't know if this is true, but I think the story was they gave him a bunch of money and said, go make something interesting, right? And they came back and it was, they couldn't, Macromedia couldn't put his name on it because it was so vile and disgusting.
Yeah, you have to be really careful with developers when you tell them make something interesting. You're never sure what you're going to get on there. Yeah. I mean, one of the reasons why I have such a good time at work at Night Dive is because the games that were created then, nobody told us we couldn't do it, so we just did it. There was a whole bunch of technology that we invented. We didn't have this thing. I mean, look at Carmack and Romero and the work that they were doing early on. They invented the word game engine. There was no concept of that before, but we put that out there, and it's the creativity behind that always blows me away. The people that we have on board at Night Dive are mostly people that have grown up their whole lives with computer games. We have a relatively, you know, it's a relatively young, everybody's relatively young compared to me. We have a relatively young crowd working there. And so computers as a gaming platform, as a platform for creativity is something that they've known all their lives. Back in the 80s, we were really wrestling with the question of whether computers were the stuff that was created on computers could be considered art. I mean, that was in the book. Boy, this is really dated, but Zen and the Art of Motorcycle Maintenance. There's a whole discussion about whether things should be considered art or not if you make them on a computer, as though the tool that you use, in any way impacts the creative impulse. It doesn't. It's kind of agnostic. You can create anything. You know, you can create music using water glasses, right? I mean, you don't have to be limited to what people traditionally, you know, identifies that as the instruments of your trade.
When you started talking about Total Distortion, I looked it up and I found, I think it's really interesting, an Entertainment Weekly article from 1995 talking about, I don't know if I'd call it a premiere, but Total Distortion being shown off at the Sundance Film Festival that year. And I think that speaks to that era particularly. I mean, even now games sort of have this contentious, like, we are important culture, we're as big a deal as the movies, you know, kind of thing going on. But especially at that time, I felt like that was sort of the blossoming of games like Myst really like penetrating into popular culture, and like the CD-ROM sort of pushing games into being taken more seriously as, you know, a form of entertainment beyond, you know, what kids were playing on their Game Boys, right?
Before I got into the game business, part of my background was working in hardware sales. Games were why we developed all of the hardware that we did. I mean, games were always pushing the envelope, you know, whatever the video card was, whatever your number 9 video card was, you know, we'd come up with a game that would require something more powerful, and that's what drove those sales. The other thing that I think is a legacy from the work that John Henry did and the legacy of programs like Macromedia Director is that it really opened up the doors to who could be creative. We would not have had the words influencer then, but that certainly set the stage with the idea that somebody without a whole lot of mathematical background, without a whole lot of, you know, that this was no longer the area that was only mathematicians and engineers, but that anybody could make some really cool creative stuff. Hey, John Henry, do you mind if I ask you a question? I mean, unrelated to what we've been talking about, but what was it like for you as a person of color working in the industry then?
Back then,
was there a lot of opposition? Was there a lot of?
No, I think at least with the Macromedia crew, they were. It was like a band of renegades. You know, there were musicians, artists, and. You know, that we were all kind of unified against the the man.
That's right. That's right.
People who were, they were always trying to kill director, you know, Flash. No, Action. Action was a product, which was a presentation product that involved animation before Flash came out. You know, so it was always that dynamic. It wasn't my, I didn't experience any overt racism, because I think there it was, and I think especially in the tech industry at that point, it was what you did, you know, your portfolio that was interesting, you know, because if you could do the stuff, then you'd get privilege. But I, there's some, you know, I didn't have the business sense, you know, of stuff with, like, ownership. I had a little clue about it, but yeah. I didn't grow up around, like, Bill Gates. He grew up, his father was a lawyer, so yep. He came from software from a legal point of view. So he never had the superior, you know, technology, but his background was about, you know, licensing and all that kind of stuff. So, yeah, so my personal experience was, it was a ball. And, I look at it as a platform for enabling, and you know, I have a strong interest in teaching, and that's one of the reasons why I'm back at NYU. And I see that making this technology accessible to people across the board, you know, especially African American fashion, with this kind of, you know, discriminated against and kind of put into a corner.
Yeah.
And then being able to present that as possibilities that a lot of times the high school teacher, their guidance counselor won't advise them about, you know, this kind of creative work. So, I see it as an opportunity to you know, I experienced the best side of technology.
I'm very active in the IGDA, the International Games Developers Association, and I talk a lot about how much of this stuff, because of the low barriers to entry. You don't have to have a factory to make a game. You don't have to have a game factory to make a game. You can do that on a PC. And if you're making games in either the classic style, or it doesn't even have to be the newest PC.
Do you still do a lot of programming today?
Yeah. Still, I'm right now, I'm kind of half teaching and half looking at creating some interactive art and using art, you know, building artwork, and using technology for, you know, some social good. I'm working on a COVID impact project now, where I'm taking the COVID data and, you know, visualizing in a dashboard, with the goal of the dashboard is to connect the numbers to the actual lives that have been affected, especially essential workers and you know, people, African American folks that have been most impacted or are still being impacted by the virus. And with the enormity of the numbers, you don't really get a sense of the impact. So the multi-generational impact and that kind of stuff. So the COVID impact project is about, you know, taking the raw numbers and connecting them to the stories of who they're impacted, pretty much similar maybe to you know, to the AIDS quilt, where there's some kind of a physical manifestation of this tragedy. And it's an ongoing tragedy too. So stuff like that, you know, COVID impact project, interactive art and teaching is what I'm dabbling in now.
Larry, did you have anything you wanted to add or ask?
No, but again, if you think about the past 20 years and the direction that that software has gone in and that games have gone in, it was not necessarily something that we expected, but very gratifying to see how it's grown and how it's really matured as an art form.
Well, that feels like a good place to wrap up. I want to thank both of you so much for your time and joining us. This has been a fun conversation to be a part of, and seeing you both relive a bit of your 90s PC history. It was certainly educational for me, so I hope you enjoyed it.
Yeah, so it was fun to reflect that.
Thanks for the forum and thanks for the introduction. It was a pleasure meeting you, John Henry.
Yeah, nice meeting you too. All right.
And John Henry, I don't know if you, I know you don't use Facebook, don't use social media much. Is there any place you would say we should direct people if they want to learn more about what you're doing today?
You can go to my website, johnhenrythompson.com. From there, they can see what I'm doing. I'm migrating it to GitHub. So there's a GitHub. I am JHT1493 on GitHub. That's another place you can find me.
Great. And Larry, what do we have to look forward to for Night Dive?
Couple of things coming down the road on that. Some console games, some PC news, and just always keeping our hands in.
All right. And your games are all on Steam, all on GOG, is that right?
Pretty much. Pretty much can be found in those places, as well as more and more coming on consoles.